Hey everyone, and welcome to this Thursday show. Thank you for joining me again. I always enjoy these. So as usual, if you do have any questions or topics that you'd like to talk about especially, mention them in the chat and I will do my best. All right, the chat moves pretty quickly, I admit, so at times I might lose something, but I do the best that I can. Also remember to turn up your resolution if, you know, one of these companies that hates me over at Big Tech, like YouTube, has me down at, you know, 240 or 140, whatever the heck it is. Feel free to turn it up because it should not be that low. Okay, so let's go ahead and jump right into this because I don't like to waste your time. Let's start with the fact that a transgender Muslim has had to flee the country of Malaysia because this person who we're talking about going from a biological male to pretending to be a female decided to wear a hijab to prayer. And shockingly enough, the Muslims of the country in Malaysia didn't appreciate that too much. And honestly, I don't know about you guys, but I find that entirely shocking because I've been told that Muslims are particularly peaceful and tolerant, and therefore I don't see why they would have a problem. But this particular individual, Nur Sajet, sorry, you know, name's from Malaysia, has went pretty public about his wearing the hijab because he proclaims to be a she, and strangely enough, this Islamic country is not being as tolerant as I was promised that Islamic countries really are. And I'm told this repeatedly. I was told that, you know, I did this video earlier on this week about the Islamic terrorist attack, the most recent one that took place in England, and I did receive at least some people who were clearly Islamic, we're like, well, that's not our religion. We're peaceful and tolerant. And then it's like every news story that I come across is just kind of like a joke on them, it would seem. But in any case, this individual, this man, rather, has had to flee to Australia, despite proclaiming that he is still a Muslim, and despite the fact that he wore this hijab to pray, and all the Muslims in Malaysia, effectively, turned against him and said that was a violation of their faith and that this person should be punished. He had to flee to Australia, which is interesting because Australia is not a Muslim country. So he had to flee to a non-Muslim country in order to find the peace and tolerance that we are promised comes from Islam. Right? Because that's what we're promised. And so he is now in quarantine in Australia. Ironically, in Australia, despite how tyrannical Australia is right now, that's still a little bit more free, from his perspective at least, than Malaysia is. I mean, I don't know about for a regular person so much, but I guess if you're willing to dress up as a woman when you're actually a guy, you might find Australia to be a little bit more peaceful and tolerant and less religion of pieces. You know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. You do know what I mean, because we've been covering this for long enough, and you know, there's always somebody who gets really bent out of shape after I do a video on this topic, because there's always somebody who's like, how dare you say something to that effect about that religion of peace? And we just kind of end up circling back. Yeah, I know, that's a great phrase now. Circling back repeatedly into one act of, can we call it extremism or just, you know, sticking to the book when it comes to Islam? Yeah, I know, it's okay. Anyway, I should probably move on from there. One of our chatters says, I got unsubscribed somehow on YouTube. That doesn't surprise me in the least, actually. What surprises me is that there are still some people actually subscribed on YouTube. I'm like, you know, I'm sure that Big Tech doesn't want that to happen. If you do want to get reliably notified of shows, there's a mailing list subscription a mailing list link in the description that you can use to sign up, and that way Big Tech won't control what you see. Okay, and I do want to talk a little bit actually about that Islamic attack, since we're on the topic of the religion of peace, as again we are promised. That is the fact that, as you may know, I did a video in more detail about this, but David Amos was a member of parliament over in England, and he was recently stabbed to death in an Islamic terrorist attack by a Somali immigrant. All right, now I'm not going to cover that attack again, but I do want to talk about how that death is being exploited now to try and take away the rights of native Brits, which is so evil. It really is. Like, the whole idea of standing essentially on the grave of somebody who has been killed in such a, you know, horrific way in order to promote a political message that would have infringed upon the rights of even that person is personally bothersome. So it turns out that, you know, the individual, the member of parliament who was stabbed to death, was a member of the Conservative Party, at least named the Conservative Party. It's not actually Conservative. I don't want to confuse anybody here, but that's what it's called. And it is slightly, ever so slightly more right-wing than the Labour Party, which is the dominant leftist party. But I mean, they're so close, and calling the Conservative Party over there right-wing would be such a, it would be so erroneous. It really would. So I don't want to make that mistake. But in any case, the Conservative Party, which is currently in power over there, has been seeking to exploit this death in order to take away people's rights. The Home Secretary, Priti Patel, suggested that the government will seek a ban on anonymity on social media following that Islamic attack. All right. And a lot of so-called conservatives in England are in agreement. That is, members of parliament. When I say conservatives, I don't mean actual regular people on the streets. They're suggesting something called David's Law in order to make sure that people can't speak freely on the internet. I don't know, like, how do you even kind of make this connection? I mean, seriously, I try to empathize with people with whom I disagree. But when I look at this and I say, okay, so there's been this Islamic terrorist attack, therefore we do something with Twitter because people are mean on it and they say mean things. Like, I actually don't see the connection there. And the truth is that there isn't one. There is, at this time, no connection whatsoever between social media and some Muslim immigrant deciding to stab a member of parliament. There simply isn't. There are some people who would like there to be, but there isn't. There are also some people who allegedly knew this member of parliament and say that he was upset with the fact that some female members of parliament received misogynistic messages online. That also has nothing to do with his death, right? I mean, he wasn't killed in any way related to that. And even if he was, it still wouldn't justify infringing on people's inherent right to speak freely, which is what it's really about. Because remember, the whole point of identifying people online isn't that, you know, that people know who they are in their society and therefore their family members can talk crap to them at their, you know, Sunday lunch or what have you. That's not what it's about. It's about identifying people who say things that are counter to the government's narrative online so that the police can better show up at their houses and arrest them for saying these things that are counter to the government's narrative. That's what it's really about. So you have to kind of think of it in the context of current British law, which already prohibits saying certain things that are offensive to other people. And yes, that's an incredibly vague term. You know, what's offensive to somebody else? Almost anything is. I'm constantly offensive to different groups of people online. I'm aware of that. I simply think that the truth is far more important than who I offend. You know, that was the Western ideal up until recently, when there doesn't seem to be much of a West remaining. But in any case, you know, that's where we are. Over in England, to offend somebody online is a criminal offense. Now, I recognize that runs afoul of natural law. I recognize that these laws should simply not be enforced. I recognize that everybody who is enforcing them, down to the individual police officer, is committing an act of immorality. I believe all those things to be true. However, people are being arrested for, you know, for things that they post that are deemed offensive by, you know, somebody who's pathetic and decided to report it to the police. That happens. And so now, to kind of up the ante, the government are trying to make it easier to track these people down by preventing them from being anonymous in any way. And some degree of anonymity has been used to try and shield people from that, and so they can actually criticize the government and government policies in a country that increasingly, you know, you can't. Let's see, Tinker Spy on DLive says, a lot of social media won't even let you sign in unless you're unidentified. Well, I will say, over in China, they have this kind of setup that I think a lot of countries are going to want to go toward. I know Australia's been talking about this too, where basically you have to, your phone becomes like your your key to the internet and also your enslavement device simultaneously. Because what you do is you hold your phone up to your face and let it take a picture of you in order to figure out if that's really you before letting you get access to the internet so it can track everything that you do, and you have no deniability to say, actually, that wasn't really me because they have this picture, and therefore they know it really was you that said something, you know, about whether Tibet really exists or something to that effect, right? you know, the rights of Vietnamese or something. But that kind of thing is going to start spreading. Like I said, we've seen Australia talk about that in reference to doing it under the guise of fighting COVID, of course, because taking away your freedoms somehow helps fight viruses. I haven't been able to see that connection either, but believe me, have I tried. All right, hold on, let me get a drink, and then I will continue. So yes, so they're exploiting this guy's death in order to basically ignore the elephant in the room, which isn't just that Islam is responsible for an attack done in the name of Islam, but more than that, the real message is multiculturalism failed. And I want to qualify that before anybody else jumps in and say that multiculturalism is different from a multi-ethnic society. That's a different conversation. We can have that conversation some other time, but we should all in the very least agree that multiculturalism has failed. That you can't put two different cultures together that hate one another, or even that one hates the other and wants to destroy the other and take it over. You can't put them together and expect everything to work out peaceably, because it won't. And that's what we see throughout, well, all of Europe, was an attempt to do that by elitists in government, frankly, in violation of what the people actually wanted, because the people were never given a choice, right? And the people were just called racist for disagreeing, regardless of the fact that races aren't cultures, you know? But in any case, that happened. But we can look at things like this and we can see that multiculturalism has failed. And, you know, that should be something that everyone can say. Heck, it failed throughout history. You know, it failed when, you know, back when the Muslims were moving throughout Europe and taking over one country after another, which led to the Crusades in the first place. I mean, just how far do you want to go back to see that multiculturalism fails? You know, when one particular culture or one particular religion, if you want to just boil it down, wants to kill the people of the other religion, you know, kill or convert, then it's not really going to work as a kind of mutual living scenario, exactly. I don't think I'm saying anything that's particularly outside the bounds of reason. I mean, sure, it's perhaps outside the bounds of modern conversation because increasingly people are too cowardly to talk about these things, but I don't think it's unreasonable in the least. And what I do find particularly offensive is the fact that this guy's death is being used, right? So you've got one guy who's dead from Islam, right? From an Islamic terrorist. But what are they doing when they're trying to crack down on speech online? Are they trying to get rid of ISIS videos? They're trying to get rid of, you know, videos from Saudi Arabia that are used inside of British mosques in order to try and maximally radicalize the Muslims who are there. Is that what's going on? No. No, what they're really wanting to crack down on places like Twitter and Facebook and so on, is what they call right-wing fanaticism, sorry. That's what they actually wanted to crack down on. They're wanting to crack down on people who say the kind of things that I say, as it turns out. That's what they're doing. I mean, I've seen the beheading videos, and that's the kind of thing that you just can't quite unsee, and sometimes you see them by mistake online, which is, you know, less than ideal, let's say. But that's not the kind of thing that the British government is interested in getting rid of and hiding, not really. That's not who they're showing up and arresting for being offensive. They're doing that for people who are deemed to be right-wing. And when you're talking about the British populace, I mean, their version of right-wing is so incredibly middle of the road that I'm not really sure that I should even be calling it right-wing. I mean, when I saw, it wasn't, I don't know, maybe it's been a few years ago, that I saw a video in which a police officer comes up to the person who's, you know, standing there and has the camera, and is harassing him because the individual with the camera had at one point said that homosexuality was a sin. And the officer actually ends up arresting him for saying this. He didn't even say like what he thought on the issue personally, just homosexuality is a sin because it's in the Bible, you know, as a sin. And he got arrested. That's kind of like British life at this point. And it seems that so few people realize just how unfree England is. In many cases, people who live there don't seem to accept just how enslaved they are. And I mention it not as a personal indictment against you if you live there. I feel for you. I mention it because none are more hopelessly enslaved than those who falsely believe that they are free, as von Goethe once said. All right, let's move on. Let's move on and talk about Canada for a bit, because I didn't mean to leave with all the international topics, but let's do it anyway. I'm apparently trying to make the Americans feel better tonight, it would seem. No, seriously though, in Canada, Trudeau, you know, their prime minister, is banning all air, sea, and land travel by train, apparently, unless you're vaccinated. He is rolling out a national vaccine passport in order to replace the passports that they already had in certain provinces, in order to have one big national system in which they can track people and harass them on account of their medical decisions. So that's evil, and you would think that these people would think back to tyrannical regimes of the past. You would think that, I don't know, if I were the one who was putting in place policies that restricted people's movement on account of whether or not they complied with me in a certain way, that I wouldn't be able to ignore the parallels between basically every totalitarian system that you had in the 20th century, right? Where the entire goal, you know, was control, which in part included control of where people can travel and how they can travel based upon what papers they showed and whose loyalty they had. And I'll say this again, you know, the passport system, being careful here, the passport system is being used to judge people's level of compliance to what we might refer to in historical terms as the party, right? That's what it's about. Do you comply? And if you don't comply, we'll make your life a living hell. And this isn't, gosh, I hope nobody is watching this and thinking that I'm criticizing them personally if they made a decision that they felt they had to make in order to feed their families, because that's not it. I recognize that some people have made that decision, and I think it's tragic that so many have been so forced. I think it's evil, in fact, that so many have been forced by their employers and by their governments in order to make a decision that runs afoul of what they would want to do with their own bodies. I think that's evil. In any case, when it comes to Canada, though, you've got these two things happening at the same time, all right? So they've rolled out these, well, they're rolling out these national vaccine passport things, which is going to start out as a kind of restriction against movement, as I was talking about the different types of travel. And then most likely that will be rolled out so that different stores start accepting it and don't. Different concerts start accepting it and refusing people who don't have it, because if you have a national system, it's a lot easier for them to do that. It's a lot easier for them to track that. It's a lot easier for them to simply control people. That's why gun rights advocates have opposed, or one of the reasons gun rights advocates have opposed, national registries. You don't want to give the government the kind of power to figure out who's got what, and who's willing to play ball and who's compliant, and to create, frankly, a list. And that's exactly what we're talking about when it comes to Canada. But at the same time as this passport system, you also have free speech being taken away by Bill C-36. The bill would amend the Canadian Human Rights Act to make it, this is very much like the England system that I was talking about before, to make it a discriminatory practice to communicate hate speech, yes, hate speech, through the internet, where it's, and I quote, likely to foment detestation or vilification of an individual or group of individuals on the basis of a prohibited ground of discrimination. All right, hold on, and then we'll just break that down. Okay, so you can't you can't. I mean, this is so ridiculous because it's like I'm talking in circles here. So you can't say anything offensive to privileged groups. That's really what it breaks down to. And if they just wrote it honestly, that's what it would be. You can't offend anybody who's a member of a privileged group. And so there goes any sort of pretense of free speech in Canada. And maybe you think that it's long gone because it kind of was somewhat vanquished in relation to transgenderism before, right? And that's what set off the whole Jordan Peterson saga when he spoke out against another bill that was meant to basically force people to use certain pronouns, the pronouns of the people who had decided that they weren't the same sex that they actually are, all of that. That got that saga started. But this is certainly an acceleration of that. And so it's like the Canadians will be living in a country, a lot like England, where they won't be able to transport well throughout the country, perhaps eventually at all, and where they also won't have the freedom of speech to offend anybody who's a member of a privileged group, which we frankly know, if we look at experience from throughout the Western world, we know that the privileged groups, as it will turn out, are anybody who is anything but a straight white male. Because that's how it'll be. Yeah, what about discrimination against the unvaccinated? Someone asked in DLive. Yeah, I wouldn't count on the unvaccinated being a privileged group. No, privileged groups are those who are protected by the establishment. Okay, John Cox says, it feels as if lunatics have taken over the governments of the world. Well, okay, yeah, in a real sense, it does seem like that, but are they lunatics or are they evil? I mean, I guess you can argue as to where you draw the line between evil and crazy, and that's kind of a almost existential question there. But the truth is that what they're doing isn't accidental. What they're doing is entirely purposeful. And what you see in one country, we're starting to see paralleled in another. And so the United States is slower to give up its freedoms, it always is. But when you look at, say, you know, Australia and England and Canada, they're kind of forming a sort of trinity of different countries that are following exactly the same path with regard to limiting transportation and limiting speech and limiting where people can go, you know, like what establishments people can enter if they haven't appropriately complied, and in many cases forcing people to choose between getting a medical procedure that they do not want and starving. And I say that because they won't be allowed to work if they don't take the medical procedure that they do not want. That part has already reached the United States, of course, through what is basically an executive order, which is absolutely shocking that that's even the case, but that's where we are. Okay, anyway. Rube's Good Brain Coffee says, the reason why the left champions the causes of minority groups is to gain power over the majority of the country in a way the majority would never consent to. Well, yeah, but it is kind of fascinating how the majority, as you put it, can be guilted into treating the minority as if it's the majority, right? By giving the minority more rights than those who are greater in number. But that's what's happening, for sure. Okay, so let's talk about the United States for a little bit, all right? Because I can't talk about the side effects that you guys are listing in the chat, except to say that I saw some. All right, anyway. In the United States, actually specifically in Virginia, more than 300 different black churches are going to hear Kamala Harris somewhere between the upcoming Sunday, a few days from now, and November 2nd, 2021. There's going to be a video message, right, of Kamala Harris that's going to be played inside churches during morning services as part of an outreach effort in order to boost the Democrat guy who wants to be governor, Terry McAuliffe. They're pushing him really hard, and they think that they're behind, supposedly. In any case, they're using these churches in order to push him. And that's kind of interesting, because Democrats have been those who have been the big champions of preventing churches from espousing political messages. And even though Trump got rid of some of that, excuse me, allowing churches to be slightly more political in areas of like moral messages and things like whether or not they can condemn a war or something like that, which they all, you know, should be able to do, and I think it's necessary to do their job. In any case, the IRS currently prohibits churches and charities that have 501c3 status from participating in any actual political campaigns, which includes publishing and distributing official messages from those campaigns. And that's what those churches are going to be doing. Now, I mention this because I've noticed this pattern when it comes to the IRS, and that is that whenever you have Democrats who are in power in the country, the IRS is weaponized against the enemies of the establishment. And yet they at the same time use it, in a sense, to turn a blind eye to the errors of their own, right? So they see, for example, 300 black churches in Virginia that have decided, hey, we're going to take the vice president and show her video message in order to get an actual, you know, candidate elected for governor in Virginia, and the IRS will look away, and those 300 black churches will not lose their 501c3 status. Yes, I know that they should if you were to enforce the law in an even-handed, just way. However, I don't think there's any chance that that will happen. Instead, what you will have is that the IRS will be weaponized against any conservative who does something to that effect, like you had with the Tea Party, of course, is the most like flagrant example. But any churches who, you know, were to promote political messages, you would certainly have the IRS all over them. And this is a pattern that you see throughout almost every Democrat establishment for like decades, quite literally. Let's see. John Solomon says people in power can do no wrong. Well, okay, but the thing is, what I am saying, look, I've criticized the Republicans plenty for when they're wrong. I try to be even-handed and actually point out when they do something that's immoral. But I don't see, when Republicans have power, them wielding the IRS in this way that so penalizes their enemies and ignores the law-breaking of their friends. And that's exactly what I see every time you have a Democrat. And I believe it was also done with... okay, Bill Clinton. I couldn't remember his name for a second there, for some reason. All right, well, we got there. Okay, all right, let's go ahead and move on after I get a drink. Okay, so let's talk about corporate America. Because it turns out that, you know how the United States military and a lot of the different companies that had contracts with the United States government throughout the Obama administration, they were teaching what we nowadays call critical race theory to the employees thereof, with no choice for the employees, right? They were just forced to sit there and be told, everything's your fault because you're white. Right, and I'm just going to go ahead and tell you, you know, calling it critical race theory just gets kind of old after a while, because honestly, it's just anti-white, and I don't want to make that unclear in any way. And I think that perhaps using this official, you know, phraseology kind of undermines what we're really talking about, especially for somebody who isn't particularly familiar or is new. There are people waking up all the time, and I don't want anybody to just kind of say, well, critical race theory sounds kind of, you know, helpful. Maybe it's, you know, critical or something. No, seriously, it's anti-white. It's designed to shame those who are white and to embolden those who are not white with a sense of indignation toward those who are. That's what it's actually about, and it's an incredibly divisive thing to do. Well, it turns out that corporate America has been doing this to some degree too. Back, and it's just recently been exposed, that there's a Walmart program that began in 2018 that was created by what was called the Racial Equity Institute of Greensboro, North Carolina. And there was a linking of those two companies, there's Walmart and the Racial Equity Institute of Greensboro, and they worked together to create a plan to indoctrinate their employees. And yes, I'll go ahead and say indoctrinate, that's correct. And this was recommended for hourly workers, but mandatory for the executives who worked at the company. But those who went through the course were required to keep it quiet. They were required to keep the information about the fact that they were in this course quiet. And the program, like basically all of these programs, says that the United States is a white supremacy system that was crafted by Europeans for the purpose of assigning and maintaining white skin access to power and privilege. It's a really odd thing to say when you think about it. I mean, if you actually know the history, I mean, it's just like race wasn't really that big back then. They just simply were Europeans who landed here. You know, yes, slaves were brought in and bought from other slave owners over in Africa later. I get that. But there really wasn't a big racial underpinning to America's start. That's not what. Okay. Anyway, I realize I'm probably preaching to the choir in this case, so I won't harp on it too much. But, you know, it's like when they, and they describe white skin like it's a disease on humanity or something. And yeah. American history in this course, this Walmart course, which is, you know, a massive employer in America, really can't be understated, is portrayed, American history is portrayed through a very tight racial lens. Claiming that America began with the construction of a white race by colonists in 1680, that before then we didn't have a white race, which is really interesting, actually, because, you know, I recognize that on the census and stuff, you often don't have white specifically. And there are a lot of people online who argue about, like, what is white versus the various different types of, you know, Europeans, for example. And nowadays, it's become really... I'm not sure how to put this. It's become societally uncomfortable to point out that there are different ethnic groups within white people, right? And that they're distinguished, right? That you can or could, prior to mass immigration, look at an Italian and distinguish him from a German and say, okay, they're different. And then look at a Scandinavian, right? Think Viking, and say, okay, he's very different. And nowadays, it's come to a point where instead, it's, I'm told at least, rather racist to point these things out. Because as things like, if we're going to entertain the term, critical race theory gets taught in various incarnations, and has been, if we're going to be honest, for quite literally decades, as that's been taught to some degree, I do think there's been this message that essentially, like, white people don't have a culture and don't have any sort of distinguishing factors between them. And yet at the same time, it's said that if you were to do the same thing to Asians, which I just did, that would be in some way dehumanizing, because the Chinese are different from the Japanese, and they have a certainly different culture from the Koreans and from, you know, the people in Thailand and all of that. Well, I mean, it's the same kind of thing. How can you say that we shouldn't lump together the Asian peoples, but at the same time we should do it every time you mention white people? Well, and the answer to that, according to the people that push this anti-white thinking, is that white people don't have unique cultures. And it's like, if you actually do any degree of research into Europe and its history, there most certainly are different cultures. Anyway, that was a little off topic. But to continue on the Walmart topic, this particular course or curriculum says that white supremacist thinking is embodied by certain qualities, which include, if you like or respect things like, and they actually listed these, I'm serious, individualism, objectivity, and paternalism, the right to comfort, and the worship of the written word. Now, okay, let me just work with the first one, okay? Because I don't want to be on this all day. But individualism, okay, as a quality, apparently we're not supposed to see that as a quality, because if we do so, then we're engaging in white supremacist thinking. All right, so if that is white supremacist thinking, then what does that say? I mean, seriously, if you really step back, what does that say if individualism is white supremacist thinking? Does that mean that every other group is somehow not individual, but is rather collectivist? That's kind of an interesting statement to make, because there are lots of people who think that that's the case, but generally you don't consider them to be on the extreme left or on the anti-white scheme of things. In fact, I think all of these qualities are actually qualities. They're positive attributes to have. To look at an individual and see him as, you know, more than the characteristics in which he was born is kind of an ideal, you know? I mean, yes, you see his characteristics. I'm not expecting you to ignore them, but I think you should, you know, see a person as an individual to some degree, with his own sort of individual destiny and his own choices and his own personal dignity. I'm not really sure how that's white supremacist in any way, but they claim it is. Now, there's the question, though. What if white people, as a collective, stopped being individualist and instead became collectivized, as this critical race theory course tells us? What then? I mean, I'm not really sure that these people would appreciate it if white people did start becoming the collective that they think we should. I'm just going to leave that kind of open-ended, because you can fill in your own blanks there, but I mean, seriously, okay, let's just break it down a little bit further. If you have countries like the entire Europe and like America that were, you know, majority white, and white people acted as a collective, then why wouldn't they simply shut the borders to people who weren't, to people who weren't white? Because they're acting as a collective, right? So if you're going to proclaim that individualism is a white supremacist notion, then you must naturally insist that collectivism is the alternative and is better. And thus that if white people were to begin acting as collectives, or as, you know, collectivist, then that would in some way be better than as individuals. But if they were to do that, then they would have to act in a rather white supremacist manner. I mean, seriously, you see how bizarrely circular this is. I'm not sure that these people really thought this through, but I have seen it on a lot of different anti-white critical race theory documents. Repeatedly, I see the claim that an adherence or a likeness of individualism is in some way supremacist, and I find that fascinating. It's all about destroying freedom. Well, yeah, but also being maximally divisive in order to create a situation where people can't... I'm trying to figure out how to best put this around and also stay within the kind of confines of what I can say. I'm going to move on for now. But the end of this course, white workers are told that they must embrace guilt and shame in order to support the concept that, and this they quite literally say, white is not right. And they must acknowledge their part in racism. Their part in who knows what racism that is, but supposedly all white people are racist, and therefore you all have to kind of accept some kind of collective guilt. That's where we are. And this was, again, this has been taught in Walmart, one of the biggest employers, and for a time, the biggest employer in the United States. And people are being forced to kind of undergo this indoctrination. So you've got a lot of the kind of leading conservative figures talk a lot, and not wrongly, about what's going on in things like academia, but they don't say anything about what's going on in the military or in law enforcement or in corporate America. Because let's be honest, you know, Walmart hires people, and a lot of the people that they hire, especially their so-called hourly workers, are people who are hired without even a college education. So these are people who, thank goodness, managed to skip the kind of indoctrination that goes on inside of academia. And then they end up in a corporate environment like Walmart, which, by the way, received a massive amount of wealth thanks to the decisions made by governments in the COVID saga. They go to Walmart to get their job, to get their kind of start in life, perhaps. Or just, you know, whatever. They end up at Walmart, and then they get told that they're in some kind of shame, or that they ought to have some kind of shame because they're white. I mean, it really is horrendous and twisted. That's all I can really say about it. It's sick to tell a person that, and to try and make them believe it, or to try and make them even say it, which is what in a lot of these programs, you're required to actually, play a role of sorts. You're actually required to say that you agree. You're required to fill in these forms talking about, you know, what white people actually did and all that stuff. And how you're ashamed. It was you. It was basically you who, you know, created civilization. And you're very sorry. Okay. Okay, anyway. Moving on, though. Former FBI official Andrew McCabe wins back full pension in lawsuit settlement after getting fired for lying to the feds under oath. This is interesting, actually. And yes, K-Tex, I did see your message on DLive, and hello. All right, but Andrew McCabe, all right, so he won back his full pension. This was a guy who lied under oath. We know that he did. And now, because he's one of the kind of Democrat favorites, now has his pension back, despite it. Now, this is why when I hear this stuff about Fauci being locked up any day now, I roll my eyes. Because I don't think it matters how many laws Fauci broke, or how many agreements that he made before he was even in this position that Trump nominated him to, by the way, in relation to the lab over in Wuhan. I don't think it matters how much impropriety is in place, because I don't believe that the elitists in our society will or do face the same consequences as you or I would. And I really wish people would stop. Aren't you tired of it? Aren't you tired of scrolling through? I mean, I'm serious. I got this, pop up recently. It was like this Twitter message where someone was like, well, Fauci's going to jail. And it's like, no, he's not. And it doesn't even matter what he did. And I think that until we start recognizing that there is a two-tier system, right, that we shouldn't expect justice to be done, then, well, you know, nothing's going to change. As long as we're all acting like everything's perfectly normal and everything's fine, then there's going to be a real problem. And what you had in this McCabe case was a lawsuit settlement. He just, you know, they settled. The federal government agreed to rescind and vacate McCabe's firing, deem him as having retired, even though he didn't, in good standing, even though he didn't, and restore his full retirement pension. That happened, and it was predictable. It was entirely predictable. We all knew that's exactly what would happen. No, Fauci's not going to jail. No, the National Guard weren't going to, you know, go and arrest Joe Biden and everybody who was going to step into office, as we were told, you know, by the Q people, right? It's false hope that's given in order to, and this is the important point, that's given in order to prevent people from being willing to make changes. It's I know I've called it hopium, you know, online, a lot of people have, and it's like, there is actually a cost to it, and that's why I think it's a problem, and that's why I think it's worth talking about, because peddling in false hope games cause everyone to look away and say, okay, it's being handled. And that was the worst part of the QAnon stuff. It was the trust the plan thing. Just keep trusting the plan because something is happening behind the scenes and everything will be fine. And it's like, no, not everything will be fine. We're losing our rights and freedoms increasingly over time. That's happening. And if you look over at Australia, for example, where they're being beaten and arrested for daring to protest, where members of the press are being beaten and arrested for being willing to try and cover the protest, where officers are showing up at people's homes for covering memes of protesting. When you look at Canada, where they're about to roll out a national passport scheme, determinate upon what kind of medical procedure you're willing to get because the government deems you to be property of it. Entirely property of it. You know, when you look at England, where they're coming up with these different excuses in order to prevent you from being anonymous online in any respect, because some Islamic terrorist thug decided to stab somebody, which, I mean, how many laws did he break there? Did they need more? I mean, seriously, it's not like stabbing was ever legal at any point. Like, oh, you know, it's okay to go ahead and stab the member of parliament. You know, that wasn't on the books. Let's go ahead and add a new law. I mean, that's ludicrous, of course. There is no law that could have prevented that from happening, you know, besides immigration changes, I'd say. But preventing people from speaking freely on the internet isn't going to change anything. It's all different excuses to take away your freedoms. No, to the English, nothing's going to be okay if you don't actually start changing things. And I think that some people need to just come out and say, when things aren't okay and things are getting worse, and yes, your freedoms are being eroded, and yes, the government does see you as property, and yes, there is a two-tiered system where the elitists in government, and I mean this in Australia as well as in Britain, as well as in Canada, and here in the United States, the top tiers of the government really are held to a very different standard than you or I. And acknowledging it is the first step in actually fixing the situation that we're in. Tinker Spy says, I guess there is a real problem with identifying what is hate. And I guess you're referencing that in regards to hate speech. And no, I disagree. I don't think that's the problem at all. I don't think there is anything that somebody else could say to me that could cause me to attack somebody else. See, that's the thing. I mean, you're trying to draw some connection, or at least the government is in these cases, between hate and action. And I'm not interested. I'm not interested in the government determining what emotional state I was in. I mean, if I'm committing a crime, if I'm physically attacking someone, then by all means hold me to accountable for my own actions. But at no point do I need some government bureaucrat deciding what it is that's on my mind, what it is that I feel, what you feel. I don't think I need some bureaucrat to decide that. And I don't think that I need somebody to decide for me that I can't hear somebody else's perspective, because it might result in a change of heart in me. No, I'm an adult. I'm fully capable of discerning my own, you know, opinions and being responsible for the decisions that I make thereafter that are actual physical decisions, right? And it doesn't frankly matter if I do hate somebody or some group. It's still not the government's business. It's not the government's business if I were to say something truly extreme by my own standards about some group that I especially hate. It doesn't matter, because it's not the government's business until the moment that I decide that I'm going to take some physical action against that group. I have literally no interest in having the government deciding just how much I'm allowed to dislike a group and where they want to draw the line. I have none. I don't think that the government is a bastion of morality. I don't want it to judge how much I can feel, or how human I am, or where my line of dignity is. And frankly, when you get into determining whether where someone's feelings are, that's exactly what you're doing. Okay. Joseph Murphy said, it's easier to rescind than uphold. Government has a two-tier system and it will never change. I'm inclined to agree with you. I do think that people should start trying to the best of their ability, become as kind of independent from the system as possible, especially with their families and possibly with their churches as well. I know there's some talk of people setting up home churches and that kind of thing, and finding their own, you know, preachers and all of that. Like, I get it. I do think that some degree of autonomy from the way that our society is going to be more necessary over time as freedoms are infringed more and more. Okay, I think I'm actually losing my voice a little bit early tonight. All right, anyway. Okay, Bucky says, whatever happened to sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me. Well, nowadays kids aren't taught that. They're taught to go ahead and complain and the other kid will be arrested. that's the society we're actually in now, it would seem. And it's, I mean, it's just kind of pathetic. It's kind of like, do you remember by you, I mean you guys, do you remember in the sort of earlier days of YouTube, and I was just thinking this the other day, do you remember when you used to have those things where somebody would put out a video, and there would be these video responses, and YouTube actually had its own little system set up where you could do a video response to somebody else's video, right? And then they eventually got rid of that, and then it became like kind of unofficial. You know, I think the quartering and bearing and stuff, they used to kind of do this all the time. There used to be these kind of online YouTube wars, so to speak, where people would debate, argue, or whatever. And nowadays, that's not even allowed because it's considered to be bullying. And that's kind of where we are. I think it's almost like emblematic of the society that we're in, where it's like, that's kind of like what really happened on a grand scale. Like, we went from, okay, well, people are being mean to me, you know, and I just don't care as a society. That's how we treated some kind of obnoxious individual, to that person's bullying. I want you to do something to get rid of them. And that happened at YouTube in kind of like a microcosm of showing you how our society has increasingly changed, such that in countries, at least like England and so on, and eventually, you know, it'll happen here too, you'll have an attempt to get law enforcement to step in because somebody was mean to someone else. There's a reference there to Speaker's Corner. I always found that ludicrous, though. I mean, Speaker's Corner is this one area where you're supposed to go over in London, right? And you can speak freely, as long as you're standing there and you can give your opinions. And okay, well, that's great, except for that should be every corner and every street and everywhere that's public. And this is, you know, I don't think I'm really considered to even be like a free speech absolutist in those terms. The idea of just a specific corner where you're supposed to stand and you can give your opinions there, but if you give them on the next street over, then suddenly it's hate speech. I've always found that kind of pointedly bizarre. I mean, either your speech is criminal or it's not, but you don't get rights by where you stand. I mean, technically you sort of do in England, but you shouldn't, is what I mean to say. Okay, hold on. So, moving on for a bit. Michelle Vitolo is a woman who has been essentially sentenced to die in America. She's a woman who has late-stage liver disease, and without a liver transplant, she will die. Now, she got a donor who is willing to donate. It's her daughter. Her daughter is a perfect match for her, and her daughter can give a section of her liver, and in so doing, can give this woman a longer life. She's currently 65 years old. Her daughter's name is Angela Green. And they had agreed to do this, and the Cleveland Clinic had agreed to make this happen. Except neither of them wanted to have a certain vaccine. You know which one? No, they didn't want to have it. They had both religious concerns and concerns about side effects and risks from it, which is, you know, their right. And because of it, the Cleveland Clinic decided they weren't going to allow this donation to take place, which means essentially that the Cleveland Clinic decided that this woman has to die because she's unwilling to accept the status quo. Because again, I actually covered another case like this recently, but I don't think I should stop covering these cases because these are actually people who are dying, are being left to die. So I'm going to keep just covering them, frankly. In Michelle's case, you know, it's a direct donation. So she's not like on this like long list, this long waiting list of from random people who are strangers, which would be, it would still be wrong if it was that situation. But it's worse in this case because she's not waiting for some random stranger who only wants to give it to the vaccinated. That's not the case. It's her daughter. It's a direct donation. She specifically, they both specifically want to do this. And the clinic itself said, no, we won't do this. And this is spreading around the country. There are a lot of people who now are being told, that if you don't comply with this order, you'll be left without the transplant that you need to live. And there's no argument in the medical sector here. The Cleveland Clinic isn't saying, actually, you know, you can survive without this liver, and therefore you don't need it, and you can go somewhere else. No, there is no argument there. They're all saying she's got this, you know, late stage liver disease. They acknowledge that she will die without it, and they're saying you die anyway. You know, we decide essentially that you'll die unless you comply. And as of yet, this family has not complied with the edict, and so they are expecting that she will in fact have a shortened lifespan if they can't find a different clinic, which they are looking for. But my gosh, that's horrific. And the fact that that's not mainstream news, like the main thing that the news is talking about, ought to shock the conscience, I think. I really do. I think that the fact that there's that isn't the dominant topic, that people are literally being told that if they don't comply, they'll be left to die, that's not the thing that bothers us most as a sort of collective society, is shocking. I mean, really. Bob and Anne say, the CDC and FDA accept large donations from Bill Gates and his foundation, which owns lots of vaccine company shares. Yes, it's also true that the FDA and the CDC are both sort of revolving door agencies in which major individuals from the pharmaceutical companies get jobs in the FDA, and then they go back and forth and back and forth. You can look into it further, but it's absolutely shocking when you start looking into it. When I was working over at HealthWise dominantly, that's healthwyze.org. If you need, you know, health information, you can go there. When I was dedicating all my time to that, that was one of the things that we came across, was that revolving door between the agencies, these health agencies, and the pharmaceutical companies that they were supposed to be protecting the American people from, and which obviously they weren't. Alan says, no compassion or mercy. Well, none whatsoever. It's all about absolute compliance. Okay, anyway, let's move on. Because I read this poll that says that the majority of Americans believe that grocery store prices will continue to rise over the next year. And it's like, well, yes, obviously. But when you think about that, I mean, it's like, shouldn't everybody think so? Not just the majority. I mean, it's obvious. I mean, few people understand economics nowadays because, you know, public schools are bad. And I don't say that to, you know, to knock anybody who went to public school. I went to public school, to a public school. I simply didn't rely on it as my source of education. Any case, it's like this. When the price of energy, i.e. fuel, increases, the price of everything increases, because all products have to be delivered from one location to another. Simultaneously, the price of intangible services goes up too, because the people who are providing whatever service it is that you want, you know, your plumber, whatever, they all have to pay more for their groceries too. The same time, wages will have to rise to accommodate the fact that everything costs more, but yet your quality of life won't rise. And most likely your wages will not rise in proportion to the cost of inflation, that is to the cost of how much products have increased. At the same time, because wages are rising, you'll have Democrats who brag about the fact that wages are rising, as if that in itself is some grandiose positive. And it's not, if you can no longer afford to get the products that you previously could afford at your lower wage, right? Now, the average gas price in the United States at the time of the last presidential election was $2.20. Now it's $3.30. I realize that those prices vary around the country. That's why I'm using the average price throughout the United States, so that we're actually comparing apples to apples here. Now, okay, from $2.20 to $3.30, that's per gallon. That really adds up. It especially adds up if you're talking about the transportation of goods, you're talking about things like trucks, which tend to be, you know, gas guzzlers, of course. That's, by the way, that's the highest price on average in the United States in 7 years. That's major. And at the same time, another thing that causes products to rise is scarcity. And we have scarcity, well, for several reasons, but in part we have scarcity because we have businesses that keep laying people off because of mandates, right? And that's where we are. We also have people who are walking off their jobs because of mandates. By the way, like I was looking at this story earlier where 750 General Electric workers walked off their job, I think it was in Ohio, and they walked off the job because they were protesting against vaccination mandates. Well, okay, thing is, the mainstream media isn't reporting that at all. Now, that's actually a pretty major story, but why isn't the mainstream media reporting any of these walk-offs? Hey, the mainstream media didn't even cover the airline strikes accurately. They were busy saying that it was about a weather phenomenon when it clearly wasn't. I mean, we actually have the paperwork showing that the strikes were happening and why they were happening and what the people wanted, right? Well, why isn't the media covering it? The media isn't covering it because they don't want momentum to take place, because they don't want these strikes to spread. Now, that's interesting mostly because it means that the mainstream media, and you already know this, but I'm going to spell it out anyway, that the mainstream media is working with the government as essentially a branch of the government, as a propaganda arm. That's what's happening. And yes, these actions, these particular strikes, they will worsen shortages nationwide. Well, perhaps, you know, maybe if you want to get rid of that, we shouldn't have the mandates take place. Also, you have empty aisles in grocery stores increasingly for a lot of reasons. And yes, you have that as part of it, but also the fact that increasingly you have stores that can't find employees. They can't hire anyone because so many people have been laid off for so long by the government. And that's an important distinction, because these people were laid off by government mandates, either at the federal or the state level, most likely at the state level. That's what happened. The states, you know, got involved and said, these companies have to close down and we'll give these people a check, you know, once a week for until who knows when. And in many cases, the check is twice, you know, as high as what they were getting paid before. And then these people, in a lot of cases, still aren't going back to work. Well, why would they? And by the way, you know, I can understand, and I said this last time, but I think it bears repeating, that I can understand the people who, at the moment, when you see what's going on in corporate America, want to stay home and collect the check. I get it. I don't think it's a great thing for individuals not to, like, be productive in some way. I think there's a kind of inherent part of the human psyche that says that they actually benefit individually to getting something done. At the same time, we've just been talking about how Walmart has been indoctrinating people so that they hate themselves for being white. We've been talking about how corporate America has been penalizing people for not taking a medical, for not making the medical decision that they don't want to make, right? Because corporate America maintains that they own you, because corporate America reinforces that the government owns you down to your very physical body and what you can have done to you. And so I'm not going to sit here and tell you that you have to, you know, go in there. There's some mainstream conservatives out there that are really kind of hammering on these people who are staying at home with their families. And there's me just kind of sitting here going, well, okay, well, what are these people expected to do? You know, just shut up and comply, because that's the conservative thing to do. That's the traditionalist thing to do. Well, maybe it's not. Maybe if the government is the one that put you out of work in the first place, and the government's giving you this check now, and it gives you the opportunity to stay home and actually raise your family and homeschool and all of that, I'm not going to sit here and judge you for so doing. It's a very dark, fallen world that we're in right now. It is. And I realize that there are a lot of people who are struggling in a lot of ways. Hector Del Rio says conservatives are conformists. Well, the trouble is that so many of these conservative pundits are not looking at what they're suggesting. They're looking at this and they're going, well, you know, work is good for people, which it is, you know. So start a business, you know, start your own business if you can, you know, do whatever it is you can. I'm not saying sit at home and, you know, use your Xbox all day and waste your time. I think that's kind of almost offensive to the human dignity as an adult, when you should actually be trying to progress and to better yourself and to provide a good example to your kids and all of that. I'm not suggesting that you do nothing. I am saying corporate America is evil, and I can recognize why so many people want to fight back against it at this point. And I'm not going to sit here and kind of rail about the stock market. I think that people are better than that. I think that you people are better than that, and I'm not going to tell you to go in and take some shot because some government bureaucrat says that you should, and that he'll punish you if you don't. I think that's evil. Not, you know, sitting at home and raising your kids to the best that you can, that's a noble good. And I won't say the opposite. Oh, and speaking of which, if we're going to stay on a topic that I shouldn't even be on anyway, hold on a sec. I saw this headline over at Bloomberg. It was probably just before this show was getting started. And it was like, how many boosters will we need? Israel says too soon to know. And that was literally the headline over at Bloomberg. And it was actually funny for a lot of reasons. But mostly because it's like, okay, so they're pushing these things. And at the same time saying, we don't know how long we're going to keep pushing them for. It's just like forever. You know, like, it's too soon to know. Just trust them. They know so much that they can, you know, tell you that you have to do it. Otherwise, you must starve, right? Because you're not allowed to have a job. So, you know, they're going to go all out on that. And then at the same time, they're going to be like, but do it for potentially forever until we decide how long it's going to work for. We don't know yet. But yeah, keep taking that thing. But we don't know how long it's going to last. Just wait and see. And by the way, to the agents of big tech who are watching this, I am, of course, in full favor of booster shots forever. Personally, I've been looking for ways to commemorate every 3 months of my life forever. You know, I just haven't been able to get other people on board with the gifts every 3 months. Maybe now I can. No, seriously, it's like the state now throughout, like, the Western world maintains that it owns its people as property. And, you know, I've seen some people over the years who've talked very negatively about the way that in the United States military, right, a person is kind of deemed to be sort of property, and the medical experiments that were done on the different soldiers, and that goes back to the kind of nuclear experiment, if you want to go back and take this away from vaccination and instead kind of keep us on point. But now you're talking about regular civilians who didn't sign up for any of this, who are simply supposed to be citizens and not subjects and not slaves, instead told, I mean, I actually think that if you go back in time to various different instances of slavery, because I'm not going to pretend like there's only one slavery and it's been, you know, cattle slavery here in the United States, that's not the case. If you go back and look at a lot of slavery that happened around the world, there was kind of seemed to be something that was a little bit iffy about this kind of thing, about forcing a certain substance into a person's body like that, you know, that. But in any case, that's where we are, and that's the way the government sees you. Not as a citizen, but as a kind of slave in the sort of, I guess you could say, low-class slave sense. Okay. All right, moving on. I did see the New Jersey Economic Development Authority is telling its employees to avoid events with only white male speakers. Now, I find this interesting because the Economic Development Authority, like it sounds like, is an actual state agency in New Jersey, right? And at first, I saw this a bit back and I thought, that's probably not true, maybe, you know, because I tend to be kind of an optimist. And I'm like, things can't be that bad. There's always a part of me that's like, it's not quite that bad. But in fact, the New Jersey Economic Development Authority confirmed this story to the local radio station, New Jersey 101.5. And literally said that under most circumstances, the New Jersey Economic Development Authority staff will not participate when the panel of speakers are wholly comprised of white males. And that if staff are asked to participate in one of those panels, they'll inform the requester of this policy and then suggest additional diverse speakers. And so when you say diverse speakers, again, that's a euphemism for non-white, right? Because that's what they mean by diversity. They literally mean non-white because they apparently don't have a problem in a panel full of, say, black men. Okay, they don't have a problem in a panel full of Asian women. That's not what they mean when they say diversity. What they mean when they say diversity is we can't just have all white men specifically. So diverse means non-white. All right, now that we've got that cleared up. And it said that, they specifically said, well, sending a woman or a non-white male staffer to take part in such a panel would adhere to the policy. and therefore they would show up and give their speeches. And can you imagine what that would be like? I mean, just pause for a minute, okay? Because I've actually thought about this, and I was thinking, all right, so imagine being that person. Like, you know, if I was working for some agency and someone said, hey, Sarah, we need you to go to this panel because you're a woman. Doesn't really matter what you say. I don't think you're qualified because you're a woman, but you need this kind of leg up because you're a woman and you wouldn't be able to get this opportunity anyway, you know, by yourself on your own merit, but go for it because, you know, you're a woman and therefore you need this particular placement. And can you imagine being that person, the receiver of that sort of message? Because I don't think I'd feel entirely comfortable playing token woman, which is what they're talking about doing, because that's what you do when you say, hey, this panel isn't diverse enough for me. I need a token of a certain race or a certain sex in order to compensate for the fact that it doesn't fit my narrative. And by the way, this particular agency provides grants, if you're wondering what it actually does. And according to its official mission statement, quote, creates good jobs for New Jersey residents and provides pathways to a stronger and fairer economy, unquote. Fairer how, is my question. I mean, how do you determine what's fair? Because if I look again at the previous example that I just gave, when, you know, they're like, Sarah, we need a woman, you're not qualified, but, you know, we have a spot for you, and we don't know who else to fill it with. I'm using the woman example because it's far easier and people get far less upset because I am a woman, so it gives me certain more free speech in a certain area in our society, because that's ridiculous, but that's the way that it is. Is that fair? Is that a fairer economy? I fail to see that it is. And by the way, I'm going to wrap up the show fairly soon, so if you do have any questions or topics you want me to address, go ahead and put them in there. But it's kind of Orwellian the way that we're redefining terms. Because to say that that's fair, when it's intrinsically unfair to the white men who presumably are qualified, else they wouldn't be there, and if they weren't qualified, then surely there had to be something that you would say other than they're white men and therefore they're a problem. Because we're not talking about, well, this panel is lacking somebody of a certain quality. You have an actual government agency saying, because they're white men, we won't acknowledge their existence enough to go and speak. Enough to, you know, go and this is an agency that's designed to kind of give money in order to try and build up, you know, businesses in different areas to promote fairness. But fairness to whom? Because that's not the sort of fairness that I was raised to accept. I certainly don't want to be treated in a way that says, hey, you're a woman, here's this job, you know, figure it out. And because it's a government agency, the money that they're dealing with is your money. It's also white men's money. There's a chance watching this that you're a white guy, right? And this is something that you, if you lived in New Jersey, would be paying taxes into in order that it might discriminate against you and then justify that by saying that it's fair. That there is nothing fair about any of that. It's evil. It's evil, it's wrong. And that's where we are. White people need to hold a nationwide tax strike. Well, honestly, it's kind of getting that way as we look at, it's not just New Jersey, we're starting to really see these agencies all over the place. There was something over in Asheville, North Carolina that I I did a video about a long time ago, where they were rolling out what they called reparations, which was in the form of giving specific tax credits to individuals and families who were not white so that they could, you know, basically do better. And then they simultaneously referred to that as a type of fairness to encourage diversity. It's like we're talking in circles and redefining terms at the same time in order to say something that isn't true. All right, let me get a drink and I'll see if I've got any more, if you guys have anything else you want me to cover here. Richard says, small business is the most fair employer because incompetency will result in bankruptcy. government supports all kinds of idiots. Well, yes, but that's why they've been trying to destroy the small businesses. And I do really think that's one of the reasons why the COVID-related decisions were made. Because the COVID-related decisions basically said small businesses matter less than mega corporations, right? It gave favor to companies like Amazon and Walmart at the expense of smaller companies, and said that basically the smaller companies had to shut down. They didn't have enough square feet in order to separate people out, right? And they came up with all these different excuses, and then they redefined what was an essential business and what wasn't an essential business, and shut down all these different companies. And then those companies, many of which went bankrupt because they couldn't just kind of get rid of all of their stuff for several weeks at a time. This is actually the case with some restaurants that just kind of went out and couldn't do it as well. But that happened. And as these stores shut down, where did all the money go? Well, people just bought on Amazon and on Walmart, at Walmart. And you had the biggest transfer of wealth in history. And the Democrats, with people who were pushing hardest for it, in favor of the harsh treatments, in favor of infringing upon people's rights, and in favor of this transfer of wealth from the middle class to the richest, and yet they will complain that, you know, that the top 1% has so much more wealth than the rest of us. It's like, well, how do you think that happened? Like, it literally took place because of policies that were pushed most aggressively by Democrats, but honestly, I'm not going to sit here and lie to you, the Republicans were awful on the issue as well. The Republicans, who many of whom talked about how they would, you know, liberty or death, and then came this virus, and they were like, well, you know, maybe not so much. It was incredibly galling. Okay, in any case, John says, spot on, Walmart was wide open while small businesses were blamed for COVID spreading. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, and so many of those small businesses were like multi-generational businesses, and those families were destroyed. And, you know, if you're self-employed as well, you may not know this if you're not self-employed, but you don't get things like unemployment. You know, unemployment, when you get unemployment, it's because you paid unemployment insurance that was taken out of your paycheck, and there's an entire system for that. However, that doesn't take place if you're self-employed. So there's a tremendous risk that comes with being self-employed. There's also a potential for, you know, for doing really well for yourself too. And of course, that's the incentive. That's supposed to be the way that it is. That's how capitalism works when it works. However, you know, that's not where we are. Kodum says, Sarah, are you based from the UK? Seems like lots of your content is about the US. Is Europe a lost cause? I am not based from the UK. I could not do the show that I do from the UK because I simply say the truth, and that's not allowed over there. That said, I did grow up in England, and I came here at the age of 16. I've been here since. A lot of my content is about the US because this is not only just where I live and therefore of kind of pertinent interest to me, but also because I see it as the last hope for freedom in the Western world. I think that if the United States falls, there's not much hope for anybody else. And therefore, it's a topic of greatest concern. It's also the country that cares most about the system of inherent God-given rights, which is unique at the current time in the Western world. You don't see, like, over in England, since you mentioned it, you kind of have this view that, well, yeah, there are certain rights, but those rights are given to you by government, and therefore they can be taken away from you by government. And so they're not really rights so much, they're privileges, as a lot of Americans would say. But over in England, they'll say, well, yes, you've got this right, like the right to free speech, except for when the government says that a certain thing is hate speech, and you don't have that right anymore because the government has redefined it. And what's unique in the United States is that there's, you know, the founding documents recognize that certain rights are given to you by God, and therefore you have them kind of inherently, intrinsically. And that changes American culture in a fascinating way, and it makes it better and more resilient to tyrants. Obviously not entirely, because if people don't stand up for their rights, then they will lose them. And we have seen that happening because people saw, well, there's this virus, and therefore we have to kind of give up on our right to peaceably assemble and our ability to protest, i.e., you know, petition the government for redress of grievances, and we have to give up certain rights to speech and all of this, and maybe our right to, yeah, okay, I get it. But in any case, that all took place, but in a lesser way, and I do think that the love of the system of natural rights or natural law amongst Americans is why there are so many more freedoms here. And I think as America gets more secular, like culturally, not necessarily in government, but gets more culturally secular, you'll start to see the same sort of tyranny. As for is Europe a lost cause, by and large, yes. And that's actually part of the fact, because of the fact that it's not just the governments that are the problem. The governments are a result of cultural decay that has taken place throughout the nations themselves, and that's a lot harder to fix. You know, it's like if you simply had a government that was just bad, you know, in a certain place, well, then the people could just replace them, you know, one way or another. But if you have the culture itself that accepts these kind of incorrect notions, and I'm just being generous here, then there's not really much to go with unless the society itself entirely destructs and then something better rises from its ashes. And that's actually, it's ironic really, because that's what communists want to happen, except for what they want to rise from the ashes is not something that I would ever dream of as being utopian in any sense. But I actually think that to some degree you have to have a fall before you can have the recognition that something else has to happen in these countries. All right. Okay, guys, it is late and we've been going on forever, so I guess I am going to go, but I do really appreciate you joining me tonight, and I will be back again next Thursday, and I'll also be releasing at least a video, maybe more, in the meantime, that is kind of short and on point, as I did in the last week. I hope you enjoyed that. All right, thank you, guys. Have a wonderful night, okay? All right.